See? It doesn't matter where you're at, counsel. Quite frankly,
I was told.
As long as we get the appellant to the podium first, it's. You can move it in, but don't obscure counsel, and they should see, be able to see what you have, or give them a small version of it. We have projectors and video equipment to view it on these computer screens we have on our desk, so for future reference, it works best to just bring in something to put on the projector, and it's illuminated up very close for us. Counsel?
Yes, Your Honors, my name is Todd, Todd Davis. I represent WGW.
And how much time would you reserve?
3 minutes, please.
All right. Proceed.
This is an appeal from summary judgment orders, and the primary issue is whether a commercial lease should be rescinded due to failure to disclose material information.
Now, let's, material information. I assume that, well, isn't, he understood that there was going to be a transit line somewhere near this property. So what is the precise information you say was withheld that, that you were entitled to know?
Right. The precise information is that Sound Transit had designated the legacy property as a potential acquisition, but it goes beyond that. In the July 2011 final environmental impact statement, Sound Transit had about 20 different potential routes, and the route in question is C9T. And in Appendix G2, Sound Transit had for Route C9T listed about 20 properties that were potential acquisitions. The two properties in question, however, are the properties immediately west of 405 by Northeast 6th Street. That would be the northwest property on the north side of the street and the legacy property on the south side of the street. Both were designated in Appendix G2. That's information number one. Information number two is that in the November 2011 Memorandum of Understanding, Sound Transit and the City of Bellevue agreed that Route C92 would be the route through downtown Bellevue, but it was very clear that more design work was required. In fact, not only did they say that, they said, we want to institute a cost savings process to save the city $60 million that's going to involve design refinement.
So with regard to that, so I assume that Mr. Guo, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly.
Yes, Mr. Guo, I've struggled with that pronunciation.
So I apologize if it's incorrect. But so he had some knowledge that it was going to come near his parcel, one way or the other. So why wouldn't he ask him, now, are you sure it's not going to come over my property or not? I mean, that's like one question to me. That's
Because Nelson, the property manager for Legacy, confidently told Mr. Guo, it's going to be on the north side of the street. And we're not talking about an ordinary street. We're talking about a, what is already a freeway overpass. So it's a wide street, built up a bit. It's a freeway overpass. So, but there's another bit of information here. The cost savings process, Nelson attended that April open house. And the paperwork that was presented to the attendees said that no decisions would be made on the cost savings process until 2013. Now, the lease in question was signed in September 2012. So not only did Nelson say, oh, it's going to be on the north side of the street, which is just incorrect because it was just a preliminary depiction. It was only 30% engineering design. But he was confident it's going to be over there. And there was he voiced no reason for concern. Instead, Nelson said, this is going to be good for business. It's going to increase foot traffic. This is great. So there was no reason for Mr. Guo, that's how I pronounce it, to go home. Really? But it goes beyond that, all right, in terms of why wouldn't he ask questions? In addition to being the property manager for the legacy property, Nelson also happened to have a broker's license. That's how he got a commission on the lease. Brokers have a statutory duty to disclose material information not readily ascertainable that has a negative impact.
Does it matter for purposes of our appeal that the motion to amend the complaint to add him as an individual party was never granted?
Well, we decided not to amend the complaint. We didn't do it.
I thought there was a motion made.
Yes, but we chose not to do so, and here's why. Our primary remedy is rescission. There's no way Nelson can provide rescission. That's the primary remedy that from the very beginning WGW, Mr. Guo, has been seeking, from 3 weeks after finding out about Sound Transit's designation. Nelson knew all of this stuff, but he just didn't disclose it. He didn't connect the dots. I submit he was highly negligent in not connecting the dots, but he didn't, or at least he says he didn't, but for certain he says he didn't disclose it. By negotiating a 10-year lease without saying, ooh, by the way, maybe you might want to check this out, I don't think this is a problem, he's necessarily implying that there's no reason for concern. We can provide peaceful and quiet enjoyment for the full 10 years.
Is your theory negligence or fraud?
It's primarily fraud.
So you're saying it was intentionally withheld?
Well, he withheld it. We don't have to say that it was intentionally withheld. When you fail to disclose material information, that is deemed fraud.
Doesn't he have to know it's material himself, though?
Well, he can't hide behind his own negligence. In fact, the restatement had a very good example that is cited in my reply brief about a vendor who, you know, assures a buyer that title has been adjudicated in his favor by a particular court, but neglects to mention that case is now on appeal. And the restatement says, that's wrong, that's inequitable, that's fraud. And the restatement goes on to say, even if the vendor believed the appeal was without merit, the buyer, now we're not talking about a buyer situation, we're talking about a lessee, the buyer was entitled to know the facts and form his or her own opinion. Any other questions here on that? All right, so on the issue of imputed knowledge, there's a statute that I do want to address that the trial court may have relied on but not mentioned in its ruling. RCW 1886-100 states that knowledge of a broker is not imputed to the principal. It says that, okay? So, oh my gosh. Except for one detail. Nelson obtained all of his information as the property manager for the property. That statute doesn't apply. He's been working as property manager since 2006. That's why he reviewed in 2011 the Memorandum of Understanding and the Final Environmental Impact Statement and Appendix G2. All right. Now, in terms of vicarious liability, there's another statute that I definitely want to address. That's 1886-090, and that says that vicarious liability in a principal broker situation.
You can proceed into your rebuttal time if you wish.
I'll make it as quickly as I can. It doesn't apply. Hold on. It does not exempt Legacy for two reasons. First, Legacy's agent acted as both property manager and broker, and that statute flat out says that the common law still applies. And secondly, subparagraph 1B of that statute says that the principal remains responsible if the principal benefited, clearly Legacy benefited. The judgment against the broker cannot provide the needed relief. And that needed relief, of course, is rescission. And I want to reserve the rest of my time.
Counsel, before you start, the clerk's office brought to my attention that supplemental clerk's papers were submitted to the clerk's office. There has not been a motion filed, and so those records are not before the court, so please don't address them in oral argument.
That's fine, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Tim Graham. I represent Legacy 530 LLC, the sole defendant in this case. Firstly, the standard of proof here on fraud, negligent misrepresentation, or rescission is clear, cogent, and convincing evidence. Summary judgment should be affirmed for several reasons. The case we cited was Austin versus Edel. It cites the Van Denton case, also cited by the appellants. This case involved a potential future encumbrance on the premises. that are at issue.
But if Nelson knew that it was a potentially affected parcel, why didn't he just tell him?
As Your Honor asked, no one asked him about this. This information was public at the city of Bellevue, on the streets of Bellevue, Sound Transit. This is a big deal in Bellevue. It's a political football. There's questions about funding, location. It overwhelmed that community. And for someone to say, in this case, that they asked no questions, not of the speaker, asked no questions of anyone else. They had a broker, they had a lawyer, and they asked nothing, not a single question. So Your Honor's question right from the gate, out of the gate, was spot on. No questions asked. If it's a fraud case, if it's a negligence case, and if it's a rescission case, the appellants, have to do something. They can't simply sit as a potted plant with their head in the sand, whatever. They have to do something. That's the policy behind the rescissions, but behind common law rescission. That's the policy behind the Brokers Act at 1886-030. It talks about readily ascertainable. They did nothing at all. The lease itself puts any reasonable person on notice. What we have in the lease is an as-is clause, no warranties or representations by the lessor. There's an eminent domain clause, four paragraphs long, half a page. Even the quiet enjoyment section in the lease at paragraph or section 26 speaks to the landlord reserving rights to pretty much do whatever the landlord wants to do with the premises. There's also an integration clause, always important in these cases.
And aren't those clauses boilerplate clauses in commercial leases as opposed to something you specifically and individually negotiated in this case?
There are certainly arguments to that, Your Honor.
No evidence to the contrary, is there?
There's no evidence to the contrary what we have here is
you had a preprinted lease.
I'm not sure there's any evidence that that's a preprinted lease, Your Honor. I didn't draft the lease. All I'm saying is there are provisions here that the playing field was completely level. The information was public information as the trial court found. This information, the Supreme Court has said the notice provided by Sound Transit is adequate for property owners or prospective property owners with respect to potential acquisitions. The common law in this state is on misrepresentation. And fraudulent or negligent is really tells it all. It needs to be about the misrepresentation or the non-disclosure. It needs to be about a presently existing fact. The cases earlier today, Your Honor, you spoke about the content in the public notice. The content here is this is a potential acquisition.
So would your argument be different if instead of a potentially affected parcel, it had been specifically designated as the parcel in this route?
Yes, it certainly makes for a better case for the appellant. And that didn't happen until September 2014. In all these notices that they're relying on dealt with the public at large.
The fact that they're relying on is that there was a written designation of it as a potentially affected parcel.
Potentially affected parcel.
Okay, you say, well, they could have found that out by looking, and I believe their response is it was a needle in a haystack. Could have been found.
You know, it's a needle in a haystack when you're not looking when you're not looking at all. Yeah, but once you get into the website and you put the plugged address in, well, you find out what effect, if anything, Sound Transit's plans will have. This is a statement that they're relying on is a statement of future intentions by Sound Transit. You cannot take that to the bank. It is not a reality. It is a future possibility. And the both briefs, and in particular appellant's brief, speak of hypotheticals, speculation, fluid, evolving plans, as you would expect
in the second, I think it's the second biggest city in the state, when you have a rail line going through for the first time.
I'm not sure I'd mention that in Spokane.
No, I went to Gonzaga.
Does it make any difference for your analysis that he was a property manager as well as a broker?
None. The reality is nobody. The question wasn't asked here, is, or the statement that wasn't made is, and if you didn't believe me, if you don't believe me, go look at Sound Transit. That's really what they're asking Nelson to say. What Nelson's looking at is 60 days of negotiations with a broker over a lease. The record shows the negotiations started August 4th. The lease commenced on October 1st. At that time, during that time, there was no specific notice to the property owner, to the property manager, or anyone else that anything was actually going to happen. And the Austin case and the Van Dinten case and the Mitchell B. Straits case all speak of LIDs, potential LIDs. One of the cases, I think it was the Mitchell case, the seller in that case heard rumors that there may be this potential LID. In this case, it's not any different. Sound Transit could not operate if it had to, or any condemning authority could not operate. If the moment a thought comes up and a plan starts to be formulated, they have to notify everyone. Specifically, if your name comes up, your property comes up, we're going to turn around. You, property A, are going to be, you're on our list. That's not what happened here. And it's not going to happen. That's not the law of condemnation. There's what you need to support misrepresentation in this situation, where a government is about to act and or could act, is as set forth in Van Dinten, as set forth in Austin. That is, there needs to be something that affects the property directly. And Austin speaks of an actual lien, an encumbrance. Not a future encumbrance, an encumbrance that is an actual lien on the property. That is a material fact. The Real Estate Brokers Act speaks of material facts, yes, but it also says it's a conjunctive test, that it has to be something that is not readily ascertainable by the complaining party. This case, the Supreme Court has said, this is ascertainable. The Miller case, Sound Transit case, 2006. This is ascertainable because the website works. Like it or not, we have to look at websites every once in a while. They chose not to. They chose not to go to any public meetings. They chose not to ask anyone. They chose not to ask Mr. Nelson because he was, according to counsel, so confident. Remember, they're building a business here on their lessor's alleged statements. They signed this lease because they believed they just took what he said at face value. It just simply took what he said at face value. You can't do that in negotiations that way. In this case, these are two sides of the bargaining table. And the inherent nature of the communication that was not disclosed was a statement of future intentions. The statements regarding your business is going to do fine in this location is opinion. And in Washington statements, the only statements that are actionable are statements of presently existing facts. Statements of future activity, future action, future occurrences are opinion. They're not actionable. Back to rescission. Primary cause of action. It fails, first of all, because they can't state the negligent and fraudulent misrepresentation cases. It also fails because they're at fault for their own. I didn't mention justifiable reliance, but you know where I'm saying no investigation. The rescission case is also based on the fact that the lease was in default at the time the rescission action was made. Everhart's the case there. We briefed that. Thank you.
Counsel? Got 2 minutes and 30 seconds, and I'll take the 30 off that clock. Go ahead.
Thank you. First of all, with regard to the potential for future events, we cited the Guarino case in our brief, and in that case, that dealt with pending merger negotiations that were not disclosed that affected the value of stock in a buyout situation. The court said the materiality of possible future events depends on the probability the event will occur and the magnitude if the event does occur. It's a balancing test, all right? A test actually must be applied here. It was essentially a 50% probability that the legacy property would be acquired, and Nelson certainly should have known that. And we know because Sound Transit must be acquiring the property by the second quarter of 2017 and take over the entire parking area for at least a year, that the magnitude of the event would be to close down the restaurant. So there's that. Now, with regard to the needle in a haystack language, that's legacy's language. Legacy made that argument. I just simply adopted their language. They argued that to the trial court in their brief and in their oral argument.
So help me understand what that means for purposes of your analysis.
Okay, because there's thousands of pages in Sound Transit's website, thousands of pages. And in order to figure out the real issues here, you had to go to three of the thousands of documents, and they're big. The final environmental impact statement and Appendix G2, we're talking about something like that, something 6 inches big. You got to figure out what are the important pages in that huge document. Then they got the Memorandum of Understanding. All right, and then you have the documents provided at the cost savings process open house.
Counsel suggested that you could have, if you'd asked anything, you could have typed your address into the website and come to it.
Well, there's certainly nothing on the record to say that.
I see.
And I'm certainly not aware of that. And I know that when we knew of the problem, it took our office 3 weeks to figure it out. Once we knew of the problem and justifiable reliance, there's some important quotes I'd like to mention on cases that weren't in the brief.
Did you make any inquiries with Sound Transit yourself? I mean, did you go to them and say, hey, we're thinking about doing a project here, and we're just wondering if this project that you're going to be eventually condemning property for, is that going to affect us?
Well, I didn't represent Mr. Guo at the time of the lease.
Well, I understand, but I mean, was that inquiry made?
When we found out, no. Are you talking about, did WGW do that?
Yeah.
Is that your question? No. There were no inquiries made.
So counsel is correct when he says you did not make any inquiries.
That is correct, okay? But this all goes to justifiable reliance. And we certainly submit that Nelson, who's a broker who had a statutory duty to disclose material information, not readily ascertainable, he violated that duty by not saying, hey, look, in the interest of full disclosure, here's this information. We don't think that's going to happen, but you might want to check it out.
Thank you, counsel. We've used your time.
Didn't I get an extra 30 seconds?
You did, and a little more than that. Okay. So your time is up. That concludes this matter.
Thank you.